Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hi, my name is Doreen Zaki. I am a corporate finance advisor at Stadia Capital. It's a boutique advisory firm based out of Cape Town. We help entrepreneurs raise capital across Africa. Ziwani's podcast series, Risk, tackles the practical realities of taking bold steps in business, reframing the conversation around taking gospel-inspired risks while being grounded in professional responsibility. The series reframes risk through a kingdom lens by focusing on the lived experience of believers and taking a deep dive into the unique nuances of taking risks in the specific region of East Africa. Today with me is Joram Winamo. He is the founder and I believe CEO of Sandbox in Kenya. Joram, welcome to Ziwani's podcast, Risk.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me and it's a pleasure to be here today.
So Joram, can you introduce yourself as well as Sandbox and what happens there?
Great. So my name is Joram Winamo. I am a long-time entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur since 2007 after a brief stint being employed. And I've run two businesses. So the current business I'm running is not the one I started with. I used to run a company called Wild International, a consulting firm, which is still running today and I'm still involved. But today I run something called the Sandbox. And the Sandbox is this like unique business idea where we've created a one-stop shop where you can find all the different professional services that you need as a business. And so when I say professional services, I mean services like legal, like accounting, like HR, like marketing, digital marketing. And so we've built this really robust group of 32 non-competing consultants under one roof. We are very entrepreneur-facing. We built this to support entrepreneurs in their journey of building and growing their businesses. And so they can come to Sandbox and basically find help in anything that their business needs to be able to grow to the next level. We've done this successfully in Kenya for the last 5 years from the year 2020. But we have also in the process been able to scale the concept across the world. So we have one that's running in the US. We have one that's running in the UK. We also have South Africa, Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Ghana, Senegal. So we've really grown the concept across Africa and Europe and the US, just replicating and doing the same in those markets.
Wow, I must say that's really impressive. I mean, having worked with entrepreneurs as a business advisor, even before I joined Stadia Capital, I was working with entrepreneurs, helping them put together the right strategy to raise capital. And so one of the challenges that I saw a lot with entrepreneurs is you can't afford a full C-suite. You know, you can't afford to have a CEO, a CFO, a CEO, a CTO, you know, all the C.
Yes. Definitely.
You know, all the C's. And so I think what Sandbox is doing is really important because it allows me to have access to, you know, this level of experience without having to fork out that cost that would be, you know, that would go into hiring a fully fledged team. And so let's get into, you know, building businesses at scale. There's a time when we sat and we spoke some time back and you made a comment and the comment was fail quickly at scale. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so fail quickly at scale is a mantra that I use a lot nowadays. And it's basically because having been in business for very many years, and also working with so many entrepreneurs, one thing has become very clear to me, and it's the fact that you can never always know exactly what you're getting yourself into, what you're stepping into, like you've not done this before. And so a lot of things you end up implementing in your business, while they may look very sound in your mind, you know, very clear, you've thought about it. When you get down to the market feedback begins to tell you whether you're right or not. And in many cases, you'll be very wrong. And it's through that learning about what you're wrong about that you, in a sense, start to learn that that doesn't work, that doesn't work, but this looks like it's working on a small scale, so maybe I can focus a little bit more on it. And then you focus on it and it works better. The worst feedback is that no one just buys or takes up your idea. The best feedback is that there's an overwhelming response, that you've gotten something that everyone just really needed. I have just adopted that in everything that I do. When we have an idea in the company, we face a problem, or we can see our client is having a problem. We try and create a solution, very roughly put together, you know, towards solving that problem, present it to the client, and then they'll give us feedback. Does this work? Does it not? If an overwhelming number gives us feedback that it's working, but we could improve a few things here and there, then we just build the improvements into what it is that we do. So at the end of the day, I'd say we fail a lot, and it's something that's completely acceptable in our company. I even tell my team members that I'd rather you take a step and fail than sit and do nothing at all about a problem that you face, because, you know, it's just common to us that it's through failure that we learn quickly and we pivot. And so the other mantra that I say is that it's okay to fail once. It's not okay to fail again once you've learned the lessons. It's not okay to repeat that mistake. So that's kind of how we go about doing it.
I think that's such good advice for an entrepreneur. I think for me, the question I'd ask is, where do you find the balance between failing fast, failing quickly, and the capital involved in failing? You know, as an entrepreneur, you don't want to throw in $1 million knowing that this thing is going to sink, you know?
Yeah.
where do you find that balance between investing sufficient capital to fail at scale?
So my other rule of thumb is to try and not take a risk that kind of exceeds 10% of our capitalization, so that it's small enough that if it fails, it's not taking us down. But if it succeeds, then we can pour some more resources into it and get it going. So a lot of the things we do, we start small. We always start small. Start with the lightest model. When we started our scaling journey, we start out in other markets virtually, for example. So we bring together the experts virtually. We evaluate them. We get them to start working together. Then we start to do offline activities with them. And then as they integrate more, then we consider a physical setup like what we have in Nairobi. That allows us to start with a much lower capital injection for whatever is required. Allows us to test and see whether the model works the same way in that new market. And of course, they'd also be giving us feedback about what's working for them and what's not. As the lessons start to come through on what's working better, then we start to build a science around it and say, these are the things to look out for when we are getting into a new market. These are the kind of qualities we look into for a partner in a new market. These are the kind of activities we start out with light and then build up over time. We're likely to have several experiments happening at the same time, which sometimes can be a challenge in terms of overstretching us. So of late, one of the things we talk about a lot internally is how are we prioritizing the experiments so that they're not overstretching the current capacity. Then as the experiment begins to show that it's working, then we pour more resources, more people into making it work.
I think that's really good advice. And I wish I had had this conversation with you before I started some of my businesses 10 years ago. It's just really useful. I think for me, the greatest challenge that I had, even when I was starting with, the market has not received my product well at all. In fact, the market has been extremely disrespectful and is not responding to any of my ads.
Yeah.
You know, so,
I like how you put that.
Where do you find the balance between, sometimes things take time. And I think one of my greatest weaknesses is impatience. And so sometimes things take time. And so where do you find the balance between allowing a business to run its course, allowing the clientele to grow organically versus, oh my gosh, this is not working?
So I think, again, something I've learned a lot in the recent past is just to listen very intently to the market, listen very intently to our potential clients. We've even gotten to the place where before we launch a product or a service, we take some time to do some intense interviews with that segment of customer. We interview at least 5 people very in-depth to kind of understand their context, what would be important to them, show them some prototypes of the product and just get to hear what kind of connects with them and what doesn't. And so by the time we launch something today, we've kind of put in a bit more effort into engaging with the actual customer and getting them to test the product, give us real-time feedback and the like before now we go to market and launch the product. And even with that, maybe we do a soft launch on a small scale and then, you know, let it grow. But what happens in many cases is that you tend to start with a hypothesis that's kind of true. What will happen is that as you put out your product or service, the market will start to give you very clear signals. Like you notice that amongst 10 people that say you've presented the product to, there's two that have really taken to it and eight that don't really care about it. And you ask yourself, what is it about those two that made them really get attached to this product? And then are there more people out there like the two? Rather than trying to make it work for the other eight, are there more people like these two? And then drill down on, you know, a demographic, like what's common between the two? And are there more people that share the same characteristics that you could target? And in many cases, you find that if you target more people like those two, that the product kind of gets some traction. And so sometimes the signals are not from the larger section of the market. It's just really looking out for what's working and then drill down on that. I can give a very big example of this is a gaming platform called Twitch that started out as a very interesting experiment around somebody who used to walk around with a camera called Justin. It was Justin TV. They then noticed that the largest homogeneous group that used to log in were gamers. And so, and it was only 3%. It wasn't 90, the 97% was a very disparate group, but the largest homogeneous group was 3% was gamers. And when they honed in on it, they've become the largest gaming, you know, platform globally worth billions of dollars just from that one lesson of focusing on the 3% that were homogeneous.
Wow, that's a really interesting example. And so even if the market doesn't respond, I think a lot of entrepreneurs, when you go out into the market, you want everybody to say, yes, I'm so excited to take on your product or service. Please, can I have this tomorrow? And then when you don't receive this, you know, this type of response, it can be very discouraging. But I think what I hear you say is that understand who's actually responding to your product and understand why they're responding to your product. And then, you know, figure out how you can grow it. That's really good advice in, you know, with regards to managing the first part of the risk in terms of getting into business. What risks would come after that? For me, the next risk I'd see is fine. You've already gotten your 3% or your 5%. You found something that works for them. How do you ensure that you retain, you know, this 3 to 5% for a considerable amount of period? Retain and continually grow. And I know at Sandbox, this is something that you are constantly trying to figure out on a daily basis.
Yes, yes, yes. When first, I just find it such a privilege when people buy your product or service or start using it, you know, intensely. And so it's to one, just completely take a posture where every time you're interacting with customers, you have this curiosity around how is it working for you? Is it working well? Are there things we could do better? Is there something we can do to improve the experience? This can be a huge challenge in this part of the world because people don't give candid feedback. They're just so polite and, you know, they feel like they would hurt you by telling you the truth about what's not working about it. But we just spend a lot of time first reassuring them that it's okay to give us candid feedback and that we take it positively, that we actually want to make things better for them. And then we keep reiterating. Sometimes we use different ways of getting that feedback, sometimes anonymous feedback so that people can be completely open. But at least we know the challenges people are having with our products and services. Now, you may know that as the client base grows, it gets more complicated to build systems to maintain quality at scale as well. And so at that point is where just the whole question of processes, systems that help, you know, keep a large group of people happy, because there are people who are able to do a very good job when the business is small and just having five clients. But when those clients grow to 100, it just becomes a nightmare because you have to kind of get all these, you know, systems that can drive the complexity down to something that can be done repeatably, something that can be done by other people, because you probably need to get a team in to serve a bigger client base. And how do you ensure that they also maintain the same quality standards that you as the founder are passionate about? So a lot of learning on how a business works through systems, particularly. and a lot of dedication towards putting systems in place, because it's initially expensive to put systems in place. You're either adopting software solutions, you're, you know, putting some kind of new process in place, and you have to train people. You have to rethink through, how you document those processes and train those other people to do it consistently until it becomes habit for them. And so that process can feel difficult and expensive, but once it's in place, it works brilliantly. And a lot of people I find are hesitant to invest in those kinds of processes for scale. Yeah, so that's why they end up stagnating and not able to grow beyond the founder's influence.
So in fact, what I'm hearing you saying is there's a risk in even not investing into growth, because assuming that you've already overcome that first hurdle of identifying your target market, there's the next hurdle of ensuring that you sustain the market that you've been able to bring on board and then grow it. And you need systems and structures in place. And I think for me, that is also a problem I see with a lot of working with a lot of entrepreneurs, is they've been able to scale their business to a certain level. But then past a certain level, it seems they're unable to take it forward. And, you know, this isn't even just for small businesses. It could even be for larger types of businesses. I know a few years ago, I worked with a very large retailer in, you know, the East African industry. And they had, I think, was it 30 or 40 retail outlets? And they were opening up outlets, you know, every quarter. And because they had had success for such a long time, there was almost this hubris, this pride of, look at what we have built so far. You know, we know what we're doing. I mean, and unfortunately, they had built such a big business on such a poor foundation, poor quality systems and structures. When it came crumbling down, it came crumbling down spectacularly. It literally was the largest retailer to non-existent within a 6 to 12 month, you know, span. And so I think explaining to entrepreneurs the importance of having solid systems and structures so that you can, you know, sustain future growth is extremely important. And, you know, Jeremy can comment a bit about that. But then also my next point that I want to talk about is, you know, sometimes when you figure out a market, great, you think you figured it out, and then you move to a new market and the dynamics are different. I know you had mentioned that Kenyans, I think it's East Africans, we're known to be very polite. We tell you what you want to hear. You know, if you move Sandbox to West Africa, you might not get the same type of kind yes. response that you get from us. They'll tell you, oh, Joram, well done. I'm very happy with what you're doing. And then I'll not pick up your calls for the next 6 months.
Yes, exactly. You ghost me. So there's always a lot to learn from new markets. This is something we are currently going through, because every new market we've gotten into, and thankfully we work with local people who are steeped in the local industries. So we get partners who are already locally respected in the enterprise support space, who are already operating in the enterprise support space. So we don't get somebody who's new to the industry, and so that getting up and running is a lot quicker. And you'd find that because we do that, then those local experts end up advising a lot on what the local nuances are in the market as we get in. They're able to advise on the cultural differences that are there between where we are coming from and where they're at. And so if I was to talk about Atlanta, and we started off with a predominantly African-American clientele, they have a very distinct culture, and you can see it. And when we now got an African American steeped in their culture, you could see them open up, and now they began to, you know, talk and give feedback, and also, and they were not doing that before. And I guess because they felt there was a bit of like a cultural barrier. And so it was just easier having somebody who understands that running with it. And that's the advice we had actually gotten from before, that if you don't get somebody who's steeped in their culture, it would be very difficult to connect with them. And then now you come to a place like Ethiopia that is just a complete opposite culture to what's happening there compared to Kenyans. They come across to foreigners as more quiet, you know, reserved and laid back, but it's actually only to outsiders. When they are amongst themselves, they are vibrant, they understand what they're doing, they're smart, they are, you know, they know their stuff. We just had to notice that a lot of the communication is done in both English and Amharic in a lot of the marketing materials. And that's because a large part of the population is more comfortable with Amharic than they are with English and that kind of stuff. And so, you know, whatever marketing we do there has to take both into account. A lot of the structures in the economy is very different from Kenya, despite the fact that we share a border. They have certain industries that have done very well in coffee, their airline and stuff. And so, you know, the kind of opportunities that present themselves there are quite different. Here's the other interesting thing. There's hardly any foreign companies. I think there's only like three now in Ethiopia. In the entire 100 million population. And so all the companies are locally owned, and that has its dynamics as well as compared to other countries where maybe you deal with multinationals. Jump all the way to Nigeria, and like you said, you meet a very different, very upfront, very proud culture. So yeah, we just have to keep adjusting and adapting wherever we go. And I think one of the decisions we've made as a brand is that we want that, despite the fact that we're an international brand, the people who interact with it locally in any country should feel like, you know, it's a local brand in terms of how it operates. Yeah.
And I think let's just go back to when you decided that you wanted to grow outside of Kenya. The next place that you decided to grow into was Atlanta. You know, I found that so interesting. I know typically how growth would look like is, oh, we're doing well in Kenya. Can this do well in Tanzania or Uganda or Rwanda? You know, usually the growth pathway is East Africa and then, you know, West Africa, the rest of Sub-Saharan Africa, and then you go global. But so what made you make that decision from, you know, we're doing well in Kenya, let's make this happen in Atlanta?
It's interesting. I think it was more a logical decision than it is anything else. So for one, we had a local partner in Atlanta who was really pushing for us to get started. Like, so their energy was quite high as compared to the African counterparts we were dealing with. It's actually after we launched Atlanta that the African partners now started to move faster. But the second thing is that I realized the world has become quite flat. I tell people that sometimes it may be easier for me to do business in Atlanta than it is for me to do business in Nigeria or Tanzania. And that's just because I think the internet affords us all sorts of opportunities for meetings, for collaborations, for, you know, having a lot of interactions with our partners in different countries as quickly as, so it doesn't matter, a Zoom call with someone in Nigeria, same as a Zoom call with someone in Atlanta. I think as a result of that and using innovative business models like franchising, licensing, or revenue share agreements allowed us to move quickly on this whole concept of scaling without it costing too much. And we're able to basically monitor and have all the meetings from home as well. Of course, we do travel to those locations every once in a while when there's certain big things happening. But we are basically able to collaborate across the globe with the different teams digitally.
That's really impressive. I think for me, when it comes to growth, of course, there's a part of data and analysis that's important. But how does your faith come into your decision-making process in terms of where to grow, how to grow?
Yeah. This is, I think that's a very interesting question because as people of faith, sometimes we can forget and want to be very scientific and strategic and all sorts of, management science around running the business. But as people of faith, there's just aspects of, where you pray about decisions and commit things to God. And I'd say it's been very interesting how sometimes we find a hitch, for example, in a new market. It's something that's a big challenge and what you're wondering what to do about it. But then through prayer and committing stuff to God, suddenly a contact comes out of nowhere, out of LinkedIn, and they are somehow connected to that challenge that you're trying to resolve, and they're able to step in and help you get things done faster. And so there's all these things which to the person who's not of faith may look like just strange coincidences that happened just at the right time that you needed something to happen. And then things start working out again. But of course, for those of us who are Christians, we know that it's not our doing. that gets some of these things done. It's really that God aligns certain things in the background that help you.
And in your experience, have you had situations where your faith has hindered business opportunities? I know right now you've mentioned, you know, instances where your faith has helped, you know, your business grow. Have you experienced times when your faith or your morals have made you lose business or lose opportunities?
Actually, quite a bit of it. I'd say particularly in this part of the world, like in Kenya and in the region, one of the things we end up struggling with a lot is just the whole concept of corruption. And I think if you go across to a lot of African countries, you find it pronounced to different intensities, but you will at one point or another face a challenge, whether it's trying to get some kind of government registration, whether it's trying to do business, you know, in certain circles where people expect that if they give you the deal, then you're going to extend a kickback back to them, or whether it's, that you need some kind of special license to operate in a certain market. And, you know, those government officials know how the power they wield, and they may push you to incentivize them towards, you know, releasing it faster and these kinds of stuff. And so I'd say this is literally something from 2007 we deal with year in and year out. It makes life very difficult. We've had to walk away from very big deals. We've had to, say no. In situations where we knew that maybe if we compromised somebody, the deal would have come through faster. To some extent, in East Africa, we just avoid working with government altogether, at least in other countries where the system is a lot more transparent, like in the US and in Europe and the like. We are finding a lot more government opportunities that are actually quite surprising. I've had experiences of people doing business there where they simply apply for something on email that's a government tender, and they get an email saying you've won it and come and, you know, get your contract, and things move. And, you know, that's a very foreign experience to us with government here. But that has been part of the blessing of opening up in other locations, where we find that there are certain opportunities in those locations that we don't necessarily have access to back here at home. And so that diversification of markets has really helped in opening up new opportunities for us to step into. And so despite the fact that we built our muscle saying no to things that were morally questionable as far as our faith is concerned, later on it has turned out to be a strength, because we've built a really robust entity that's able to export the solutions to other jurisdictions. And we find that it's landing in spaces where there's a lot more opportunity than what it is that we're doing back here. So at least we feel like as we tap into those opportunities, it's helping us recover from all the pain, the blood, sweat and tears we've been through here in Kenya and, you know, doing business in Africa.
Yes, the key word here is blood, sweat and tears. I don't know if there's any entrepreneur who's not experienced blood, sweat and tears, especially when dealing with government and government processes. And, you know, when I think about, the Christian population, you know, in Kenya, for example, we claim that we're 80% Christians, and yet the systems are so inefficient. And, you know, I wonder, what if even not 80%, if 40% of us said, look, we're not going to deal with government unless we're doing it in a clean way. Imagine if 40% of us just stood up and, you know, held our ground and said, no, we're not going to take any government services. Do you know, I think that would compel them to change. So why is it, Joram, and you might not have the answer to this, why is it that as much as we are 80% Christians, I put that in quotes, in this country, why do we still comply with, you know, these bribes and, you know, cutting shortcuts and paying off people to get things to move?
I'd say it's because it's really difficult to do it, you know, the following the right path, can sometimes seem like a bad business strategy in terms of everyone is doing it, everyone is used to it. But we've just found that by building a community of like-minded people, it gets easier to find solutions, to find encouragement, to hold on and, you know, continue to do the right thing. But the other interesting thing is that you probably become so good at what you do that opportunities start to come your way anyway, from maybe large foreign institutions, maybe donors, because word gets around that these are the guys who are diligent at it. They're good at what they do. They deliver and they do business with integrity. And sometimes they are looking for someone like that because when you go down a path of lack of integrity, there's so many, there's usually shortcuts, cutting corners, you know, on the quality of what is eventually delivered and that kind of thing that the society actually starts to suffer for it. So you find, like even in our country, that has been happening, the pending bills, the people who rushed for those contracts and then the government changes. And the new people do not pay you, and yet you had already delivered the bribes and everything, it starts to bite you. And so you find that, you know, just sticking to the narrow path of integrity is much better for long-term sustainability and building a more robust business that, you know, can outlast you.
I completely agree with you. In fact, one of the greatest challenges that we have, you know, working with entrepreneurs, because our job is, of course, to help them raise capital. And in the process of helping them raise capital, we need to understand their business model. We need to help them build a financial plan, you know, talk about their business numbers and how they're growing, how they've utilized their money, how they plan to use investor money. And what I find a lot is entrepreneurs like to lie about their numbers or oversell. So you oversell your numbers, you lie about your numbers, and then most entrepreneurs don't realize that there's something called DD. It's due diligence.
Due diligence, yeah.
So you've roped in all these investors who are so excited about your story. And then they're like, look, great. Here's a $5 million ticket. Great. Can we look at your books? And then they open your books.
Yeah,
and then
and
lo and behold,
story.
You know, you've paid an auditor to give you fake numbers. But then, you know, due diligence is actually an in-depth process. And this is what I keep on telling entrepreneurs. You know, it's better for you to come clean and tell us the true story so that when the investor is going through a due diligence process, they're not unpleasantly surprised. And so what I find is that there's actually a super growth opportunity for businesses that operate in integrity. Because if you operate in integrity and you say, this is where we are, this is where we plan to go. Of course, we don't have that much control over the future. But, you know, this is where we are and you're open and you're transparent about where you are. I find that businesses who operate in that way are way more likely to raise capital. And why is it that African businesses don't go global? Why is it that our growth seems limited? Is it an integrity issue? Is it a lack of skill issue?
I think it depends on how you start out, because the companies that you see failing to achieve that scale are those that start with some kind of political patronage or corruption embedded into how they started the company. And so you find that the opportunities that they tap into are not necessarily based on some product or service they built that's unique, that, you know, can work anywhere. And because that is a primary way of creating value, then you find that because they don't have similar connections in another country, it's very difficult to scale and do the same in another country. And also when that political regime leaves for one reason or another, when those connections go, a lot of those businesses, like if you look at businesses that were run in the Moi era, there are many that don't exist today and there were billion shilling companies then. And the same thing for Kibaki era companies that, you know, built on the basis of political patronage and the like. So I think it depends on how you start. But if you start with a mindset of doing business with integrity, building amazing and unique products and services creatively, that then opens up opportunity to be able to replicate that product or service because you're basically the originator of how it was built. And so if you go to a new market, you're able to tell what nuances are different that you need to adjust the product and service to, and you're able to open up markets there. And since it's solving a real problem, then your business does not grow on the basis of patronage, but on the basis of people want your product and service and they are ready to pay for it and they're ready, you know, to utilize it and refer you to other people.
And you raise such an interesting point, because if you look at politics and how businesses thrive under certain, you know, regimes, you know, a lot of people might look at it as if they are in, if I can use that word, if they are in with a certain regime, then they've hit the jackpot. But actually, what you're saying is this is actually a risk. You know, being in with a specific regime is actually a huge risk because this regime, whether they last for 5 to 10 years, and, you know, before, you know, in Africa, I told you, you could say it was less risky because when presidents came in, you know, they stuck around for 20, 30
years. Yeah, for a long time,
yes. But we're seeing less and less of that now. And so, you know, going forward, it's actually not a wise decision to say, I'm going to get in with this particular regime. It's better to just build a proper business that can sustain all regimes if possible.
Yeah, that's true.
So Joram, when it comes to navigating new markets and moving into new territories, of course, you have a brilliant team that has brought you as far as you've got to, you know, at Sandbox. But what challenges do you face when it comes to making decisions with regards to moving to new territories? You know, what happens when there's a part of your team that's, you know, keen to move to Nigeria, but there's another part that says, no, let's move to Sierra Leone? How do you navigate those challenges?
I think this goes all the way back to how you recruit your team. First, recruit people who are assertive enough to say when they disagree, yet put it respectfully. And, you know, if you interacted with a lot of my team, they actually come across with a lot of humility. But, you know, they're pretty smart people and they, you know, put their points across when they disagree with something or don't think that we're going in the right direction. I'd actually be very worried if, you know, we had a situation where we always agree. So the truth is that we fight a lot. And I use the word fight, you know, in the best possible terms, in terms of we have strategy sessions or management sessions where we put something on the table and ask ourselves hard questions around, are we overextending ourselves? Are we ready for this? Is this a good thing to invest in? Are there inherent risks in this direction that we are taking? Have things happened in the past where we took a decision like this and, you know, we ended up in a situation that we did not want ourselves in? And so I've realized that just employing different perspectives, because all of us have different strengths. Some of us have strengths in the numbers, some have strengths in the operations, some have strengths in the marketing. And so they would look at the challenges from different perspectives or their own perspective in terms of something we may have overlooked. Sometimes it's a hard questions around, are we failing at this and do we need to shut this down? Is it draining our resources and we just don't have the capacity to continue sustaining this? And those are sometimes the most difficult ones. And I have to be humble enough to, you know, to accept when they put forth, you know, really strong points that of something that I've not considered yet, that should help us make a better decision down the line.
And I think that's so important, Joram, to be able to have a team that is able to speak freely, especially with their bosses. I think one of the greatest hindrances to growth, even in a business, is when you have a team that can't speak to the founder and tell them the truth of what's happening. And so for me, even as an advisor, sometimes when I get and I work with founders, and I think for me, a red flag when I'm working with a client is having a founder who's answering all the questions. He answers all the questions. The second red flag is someone else is trying to answer a question, but he's looking at the founder or he's looking at the boss when he's answering.
Yeah, when they're answering.
And
yeah.
So I think it's just really important. It's really important as a boss to allow your team to speak freely and candidly, of course, not disrespectfully, you know, but to speak freely and candidly. And I think, of course, as you know, and I think this is to all founders, there are many blind spots that you have. Yes, you might have built a $10 million, you know, ARR, you know, growing to $100 million. It's fine. You've done a great job. But there are many blind spots that as a founder and an entrepreneur you have. And it's important to have a team to be able to candidly tell you, look, this needs to change, or this is great, but this is not great.
I need to add that there is an additional level of accountability for us that checks us when it comes to these things. That's my board. I have a very robust board that asks the hardest questions ever around our preparedness to take certain steps. It's always very helpful. They help us take some steps back just to think through certain things that we've been doing or thinking. They point out a lot to maybe putting more resources and focus around what's working so that as that is working better, we can be able to resource our different expansion or new products or services better. Yeah, just having the board is also a line of defense. Sometimes I say the biggest danger to a business is the entrepreneur themselves. Mm. And particularly if they grow to a certain level of success, and they've not built these checks and balances of governance and processes and systems around them, then they can be able to, they can start to make quite some grave mistakes at scale. And grave mistakes at scale cost quite a bit because you're losing big money. You're probably very visible because of size. And so anything that happens can make it to the media. You're probably, you know, so you have to build these robust governance structures that also start to, I say, protect the business from you as making the sole decisions and dangerous decisions that could take you down very quickly. And also just building some risk management policies around, we will not take a decision that, you know, takes more than X of our capital because that's dangerous. Or we will not make a decision to go in a certain direction until we have looked into the following things and we're sure that it's a good idea and a good risk that we are taking. So I guess risk management as a practice becomes bigger and bigger as you become more successful as an entrepreneur.
It's a very important conversation, you know, that I think we need to have on this podcast, because the number of businesses I've seen that are running that don't have a board, or they have a board whereby it's the entrepreneur's brother, and so it's not really a board that's able to give you candid feedback.
Yeah,
and
that's
so because
true.
Of that, I've watched, or rather, even as an advisor, you know, we're limited in how much we can, you know, the influence that we have over our client. But the number of times that I've seen founders who are clearly making poor business decisions, and the reason they're making these poor decisions is because, number one, they either have a team that is not able to speak candidly, or number two, or they have a weak team or not able to speak candidly. Or number two, they don't have a board, a strong board that's able to tell them, you know, question their decisions. Why are you moving? Why are you raising $5 million? You don't need $5 million. This business needs $1 million. We need to put systems and structures in before we bring in, you know, $5 million. And then I also think this is still important for smaller businesses who might not be able to afford to have a board. You know, is there a way that, and I guess this is the role that Sandbox can play for SMEs, you know, who might not be able to have a board, is, who can I go and talk to about this decision, you know, before I move forward? Because as an entrepreneur, like you said, you can be your weakest link.
I think it's important. Like, say if you're an external looking at an entrepreneur to invest or something of a sort, I think the level of self-awareness that the entrepreneur has is very important. Mm. And I think a high level of self-awareness is having that awareness that, one, as an entrepreneur, you have weaknesses, you have strengths, but you also have weaknesses and challenges. But you also have blind spots, and you don't have, you know, you're not all-knowing to have all the information that would make your company successful. And so I find entrepreneurs that are a lot more self-aware, teachable, willing to learn and take external input from others, tend to do better over time. And that self-awareness would also stream to the fact that they will not hire yes men and yes women into their team. They will hire people who will tell the truth, who will do a good job, who will be ethical about what they do, but will be able to push back when they think the wrong decisions are being made. And this entrepreneur would have the self-awareness to be able to allow them to do so. But they also have the self-awareness that they need to be accountable and that governance structures are also quite important. I think it'll be difficult to walk into a board meeting to face your board and explain why you bought a private jet or something, you know, type of thing. So just the fact that you have the board there is a deterrent to certain foolish decisions, because it's very easy when you start to make a lot of money to think, now we've made it and, you know, we can spend this money however we want, rather than plowing it back or reinvesting it. And sometimes it's not your money, it's investor money. And that's what ends up killing some of these businesses, because they didn't have sound decision making around that growth and scale. They entered markets in a hurry, in a rush, didn't do their due diligence, end up losing money, end up, you know, doing unprofessional things in markets that they end up in. And that, you know, takes their business down.
This has been such an insightful conversation, and Joram, it's been a pleasure having you on this podcast to talk about risk and, you know, your experience as a founder and your experience working in Sandbox as well as, you know, Wild International. I think for me, the key takeaways that I've had from this conversation is, number one, find out who your business works for. I think that was so important. Even if it works for 3 out of 10, find out why it works for the three and perfect it for the three. And I like how you mentioned, having continuous dialogues with the clients that you're working with to just see how to continuously improve the product going forward. And that way, you know, not only will you retain your clientele, but that can, you know, it will then grow your clientele. I think I really like that example you gave about the gaming company that, the company that realized that 3% of their clients are actually gamers. And so that's really good advice. And even when it comes to growing cross-country, I really like your business model when you talk about partnering with locals. I think one of the greatest disadvantages a lot of larger global conglomerates have when they come to Africa is coming with their own systems and structures and then copy-pasting it into East Africa and thinking that it's going to work. I think that's just one of the worst possible ways of, expanding your business into Africa. And so your model where you actually work with locals, understanding their business model, understanding what works, I think that is just such a strong takeaway. I think for me, even my final takeaway is having a board, having a team that is able to speak freely. I think for me, that is just so important, having a team that's able to tell you, look, this is what we need to do better. This is what we, think you're doing wrong. It's difficult to hear, definitely as a founder and as a boss, but it's an important conversation to have. As well as having a board members who are able to tell you, when you're moving in the wrong direction. I think that's really important. Thank you, Joram, for joining us on this podcast. It was very insightful, and we look forward to having more of these conversations. And so to our listeners, stay tuned for more insightful conversations on Risk from Ziwani from more founders, CEOs, and other key business people across Africa.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure being with you today.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live up their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.